Good morning and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on this Thursday, November 19th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. We take a look at today's headline story. On the front page, Vaccine Progress, Boys Stressed UI Hospitals, reported by Vanessa Miller. Despite reaching a new high of treating 100 COVID-19 patients and revealing plans next week to launch the second phase of a surge plan, University of Iowa healthcare scientists Wednesday shared hopeful affirmations of vaccines on the horizon, showing far better efficacy than expected or hoped. This data is better than any of us anticipated, Patricia Winokur, Carver College Medicine Executive Dean and Vaccine Treatment and Evaluation Unit Director, told the Iowa Board of Regents. We were hoping that it would be somewhere around 60 or 70% effective, she said. The fact that it's 95% effective is very heartening. UIHC is serving as one of the clinical trial sites for a Pfizer vaccine that overnight upgraded its previously announced 90% efficacy rate to 95%. Half of Pfizer's pool of 44,000 research subjects got a placebo and half got the vaccine. After months of trials, 170 people overall had COVID-19 infections, but 162 of them were from the placebo group. Only 8 occurred in the vaccine group, Winokur said. She noted Pfizer identified 10 instances of severe infection in the study, 9 of which were in the placebo group. So, lots of very promising data, better than we anticipated, Winokur said. Moderna, another company in fast pursuit of a vaccine, also is reporting nearly 95% efficacy among its 30,000 participants. Now, Winokur said, the companies are following safety protocols, watching for side effects, and ensuring the vaccines don't backfire and increase severity. Side effects reported so far are mild and typical, like those that can occur with seasonal flu vaccines, according to Winokur. Results to date show participants aged 18 to 64 reported fever, chills, and fatigue more often than those between 65 and 68. More reported the short-lived side effects after the second of 2 required doses. The luxury of having participated in this Pfizer vaccine trial is I've seen firsthand how significant these side effects are, Winokur said. And I will tell you, most people continue to work. Most people have a very abrupt stop of their fatigue, usually after 24 hours, very occasionally lasting 48 hours. They responded very nicely to Tylenol or ibuprofen. Winokur noted that typical trials distribute experimental vaccines to 1,000 to 3,000 people. Think about it. We have 44,000 people that were studied with the Pfizer vaccine, 30,000 people that were studied with Moderna, and she said, that's 30,000 to 35,000 people that got active vaccine, tenfold above what we normally see in an approval process. Despite that hopeful outlook, UIHC administrators Wednesday also reported a stressed healthcare staff, strained under the weight of a dragging pandemic that's worsening instead of waning. After UIHC on Monday reported treating 85 COVID-19 inpatients there, Chief Executive Officer Suresh Gunasekaran on Wednesday told Regents the campus is up to 100 patients in-house, a peak out of its total 850 beds. Before deploying a first phase of its surge plan earlier this month, UIHC had 100 intensive care unit beds. That total has expanded under the surge plan, and Gunasekaran said to expect another surge phase next week. That could involve another increase in bed capacity, expanded access to its flu-like illness clinic, and more visitor restrictions. Limits in place restrict adult visiting hours to 1 to 3 p.m. Visitors also can't stay during surgeries or procedures. These visitor restrictions are not anything that I take pleasure in, Gunasekaran said. I think it's really important when you're having these kinds of things happen at the university to have a visitor. But with a high positivity rate in the community, it just didn't seem safe. The hospital system has had to reassign employees to manage call, clinic, and inpatient volumes. An email went out Tuesday evening from UIHC's Director of Advanced Practice Providers asking the campus's advanced registered nurse practitioners to help in the ICU. "I have a very important and humble request," wrote Director Maria Lofgren. "During these absolute unprecedented times, we are in desperate need of help for nurses in our ICUs." She reported having contacted the Iowa Board of Nursing to confirm that the advanced registered nurse practitioners, quote, "are legally able to work as registered nurses," unquote. UIHC officials told the Gazette that no one would take a pay cut if he or she offered to help in a lower paid position. In fact, Gunasekaran and Vice President for Medical Affairs Brooks Jackson on Wednesday morning emailed hospital employees to thank them for their efforts and offer a special lump sum payment of $600 to be paid on December 1 to approximately 11,500 team members. That, according to the message, includes nurses and caregivers, service employees, maintenance workers, lab technicians, and clerical staff. The university still is, however, continuing down the path of having staff give back vacation or take unpaid leave as one of our expenses management activities, according to UIHC Chief Financial Officer Bradley Hawes. With UIHC taking a growing number of COVID-19 patients from smaller, maxed-out hospitals and clinics, Gunasekaran urged Iowans to double down on precautions, particularly as the holidays approach. "It has been a very long pandemic for our staff," he said. The article is accompanied by pictures of two of the people mentioned in the article, Dr. Patricia Winokur and the medical director, Gunasekaran. Another front page story, Iowa's public campuses freeze spring tuition rates, reported by Vanessa Miller. After couching this fall's coronavirus-compelled tuition freeze with the caveat that rates could go up in the spring, Iowa's Board of Regents announced Wednesday costs will stay put for the rest of the academic year, but not for next fall. Because of COVID-19, pausing the five-year tuition model for one academic year was the right thing to do, Board President Michael Richards said during a Regents meeting. "But in balancing the financial needs of our future institutions, we are planning to resume the five-year tuition plan beginning with the fall of 2021 semester." University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld commended the decision to resume rate hikes at his institution and at Iowa State University, as both campuses Wednesday reported financial challenges from the pandemic and looming demographic headwinds. "I strongly believe it's the right thing to do," Harreld said. "I'm very appreciative, President Richards, that you're making the statement that after this freeze, we're coming back into that model. I think it's not only right for the universities, but it's also right for families because it gives them a sense of predictability." The board's decisions leaves the 2020-2021 academic year baseline tuition rate for resident undergraduates at $8,073 at the UI, $8,042 at ISU, and $7,665 at University of Northern Iowa. Before COVID-19 hobbled campus operations, forcing courses online last spring and reshaping nearly every aspect of the collegiate experience this fall, the board in 2018 had unveiled a five-year tuition model aimed at giving students and families line of sight to their future expenses. According to the model, meant to offset declines in state funding, the UI and ISU would raise residential undergraduate tuition at least 3% a year if lawmakers fulfill the board's appropriations request, or more, depending on how much state support is below the board's ask. Under the model, rates could go higher for graduate and non-resident students, and UNI was excluded as the smaller campus has a different set of institutions it compares itself to and competes with. But Iowa's public universities have suffered from shrinking legislative financial support. "We wonder why we're having increases and the need for an increase in tuition or why we're not being able to have an increase in salaries or actually support excellent programs, Harold said. This is a big concern. Acknowledging students and families are facing financial hardships as well, UI and ISU administrators Wednesday shared some of the financial impacts COVID-19 has had on their campuses. ISU President Wendy Winterstein said the total pandemic hit there has topped $150 million, including a $41 million general fund budget reduction this year, more than $70 million in lost revenue, $20 million in added costs, and about $21 million in refunds. She said, "We're facing some very extremely challenging financial times here right now." Harold, citing realities facing higher education across the Midwest and East Coast, signaling shrinking pools of prospective students, highlighted his campus's recent endeavor to partner with a private collaborative for operation of its utility system and suggested more of that could come. "You should also know that I've asked and authorized a group to start looking for what's the next public-private partnership across the University of Iowa," Harold told the Regents. "We need several more of these to get better ahead of the fiscal headwind." The article is accompanied by Board of Regents President, a picture of Michael Richards, and also a picture of University of Iowa President Bruce Harold. And now turning to the Iowa Today page, Iowa City Council elevating police policy to law, reported by Lee Hermiston. Calling it an important step in addressing racial inequities in the city, the Iowa City Council has unanimously approved the first reading of an ordinance that will make existing police policies on biased policing and racial profiling part of city code. The Iowa City Police Department has policies that banned racial profiling and biased policing. But after conversations with the state and local branches of the NAACP, City Manager Jeff Fruin said it was important to give those policies more significance and more permanence by putting them in the city code. The City Council strongly backed the idea in its Tuesday meeting. "I'm glad to see we're doing this," Councilmember Susan Mims said. "We've had policies in place for quite some time. To raise it to the level of an ordinance, I think, is really important and gives it more prominence." The Iowa City Council has voted to make changes within the city in the wake of Black Lives Matter protests. Among those changes is a commitment to explore how the police department can evolve more into a more community policing-oriented model. "There is a lot of work that needs to be done regarding the justice systems and the policing, but I think this is a huge step moving forward," Mayor Pro Tem Mazahir Salih said. Two members of the public questioned whether the ordinance represented any meaningful change, arguing that addressing individual bias cannot fix systemic problems in policing. But Betty Andrews, president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP, called ordinances like Iowa City's a step and just one way in which change is happening. Mayor Bruce Teague said, "This is not the end game. I do believe individual change is most important when we're looking at policing." The city of Coralville also is considering a similar ordinance. In addition to codifying existing police department policies, Coralville's ordinance would establish a community policing advisory board charged with reviewing annual reports on police contacts, recommending training, and educating the public on the complaint process for those claiming biased policing or racial profiling. The Iowa City Council on Tuesday also approved members of its ad hoc Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The commission will work on collecting evidence of discrimination and racial injustice, providing opportunities for those impacted by racial injustice to share their stories, and identifying means of addressing those issues. The members are Amel Ali, Anthony Curran, Ranim Hamad, Charlene Harrington, Eric Harris, Leanna Navarre Jackson, Royce Ann Porter, Kevin John Rivera, and Mohamed Traore. On the top stories page, page 3A, state adopts new rules for student seclusion, reported by Aaron Jordan. The State Board of Education approved new rules Wednesday for secluding and restraining students, marking a compromise between civil liberties advocates and teachers. The ACLU of Iowa, which filed a complaint in 2017 after reports showed some students had been secluded for only minor infractions, applauded the new rules. "We're relieved to see these changes in the final proposed rules, which are an essential and hard-fought improvement in the protections for countless Iowa students and their families," Mark Stringer, the group's executive director, said in a public comment period before the unanimous vote. Margaret Buckton, legislative analyst for the Urban Education Network, said educators didn't get everything they wanted with the revision, but this is a good step for students and putting student safety first. The new Chapter 103, which would go into effect January 20, says seclusion may be used to prevent, quote, an imminent threat of bodily injury, unquote, to prevent serious property damage, or when a student's actions threaten to disrupt the learning environment. The ACLU and family advocates had argued for narrower uses, as when there is a threat of serious injury. But department staff removed the word serious when educators said it was too hard to make split-second decisions about whether a student's behavior was likely to cause serious injury. Another sticking point was how big seclusion rooms need to be and how long districts would have to get their rooms up to code. A standard of 49 square feet in a previous draft was replaced with 56 square feet and no less than 7 feet across, and now districts have 5 years to comply. In an earlier draft, schools were given just 10 minutes to alert parents their child had been secluded or restrained. The new rules allow an hour or by the end of the school day, whichever comes first. The Iowa Department of Education held a public hearing September 15 and collected written comments on the new rules. Most of the suggestions were rejected, but the department did make changes to require schools to keep more documentation. Board members said Wednesday they appreciate the compromise groups made to write the new rules and hope teacher training will ensure the rules are followed. President Brooke Axiotis said she wants teachers to be mindful of the disparities in school seclusion and restraint. According to U.S. Department of Education statistics from 2015-2016, students with disabilities made up 12% of enrolled students, but 66% of students who are secluded and 71% of students restrained, Stringer said. Black students made up 15% of all students, but 23% of students secluded and 27% of students restrained. Axiotis said, "I would hope that's a thought that enters a teacher's mind before they go and do it." The process to adopt new rules started with the June 2017 lawsuit by the ACLU and six other plaintiffs. A 2016 Gazette investigation found elementary students were occasionally put into seclusion for nonviolent acts, including refusing to trace in pencil, stepping out of line at recess, and pouting. A state investigation in 2017 confirmed the Cedar Rapids and Iowa City school districts did seclude some elementary students for minor infractions. The Gazette reported in July 2017 about a student at Pierce Elementary in Cedar Rapids being held in an unapproved seclusion room because she couldn't stop crying. Many eastern Iowa schools still are using seclusion. Cedar Rapids elementary students were held in seclusion rooms or restrained 237 times in the first month of 2019-2020 school year, for instance. The Cedar Rapids and Iowa City districts refused last year to provide documentation about why students were secluded. The districts would not provide incident reports saying they would identify students, even though the Gazette asked for that information to be blacked out. The Iowa City District dismantled the last of its closet-like freestanding seclusion rooms in 2018, but still allows seclusion in conference rooms or other approved places. The article is accompanied by a picture of a seclusion room at Arthur Elementary School as seen in 2019. It has padded walls, a window in the door, and a door that is unlockable from the outside. And now we turn to the Insight page and today's Gazette's editorial. Mask order better, not great. In televised remarks this week, Governor Kim Reynolds announced stronger mask and public gathering restrictions meant to impede the spread of COVID-19 throughout the state. Speaking directly to Iowans through a primetime broadcast, perhaps the first such address by any Iowa governor, makes an important statement that the coronavirus pandemic is real and it is threatening the lives of Iowans. I'm afraid that these mild cases have created a mindset where Iowans have become complacent, where we've lost sight of why it was so important to flatten the curve, Reynolds said Tuesday in remarks aired by Iowa PBS. It marks a subtle yet welcome shift from Reynolds' usual state public statements about the virus. While we applaud the governor's new tenor, we have to say the latest round of requirements comes up lacking. Reynolds expanded her initial mask order from last week to include more activities and situation, yet broad exceptions will diminish its effect. States have different fine print on their mask mandates, but Reynolds' new order is unique in requiring masks only for interactions of 15 minutes or longer. The regulation does not appear to be backed by scientific evidence. It opens a big loophole for anyone looking to find one. The White House Coronavirus Task Force recommends Iowa adopt a mask requirement for, quote, all public settings, unquote. In the latest report, all 99 counties were rated in the red zone, noting exponential and unyielding spread of the coronavirus. The laundry list of exceptions only provides fuel to the naysayers ready to pounce on any piece of the order that is subject to interpretation. Reynolds' mask requirements would be much improved by nixing the 15-minute rule. This editorial board still would favor even stronger and simpler restrictions to curb viral transmission, but a real mask mandate would be a great place to start. It's true, as Reynolds often says, police can't enforce full compliance of a mask mandate. But the same is true of all laws and regulations put in place to protect people, and it doesn't stop the government from trying. Reynolds is right to offer Iowans a sober take on enforcement challenges, but she undercuts her own message when she repeatedly falls back on those talking points. The governor has a pen for signing orders and a phone for directing her public safety staff, both crucial tools in fighting the pandemic. But she also has a bully pulpit she could employ to greater effect. Instead of reminding Iowans that we don't have enough cops to enforce a mask mandate, Reynolds should just tell Iowans to wear the damn masks. That's the Gazette's editorial. We have one community letter submitted by George Burgess of Iowa City. He writes, titled, Mr. President, we have important work to do. When I was a child, sometimes events would not go my way. I would lose a contest I was certain I was going to win. My first strategy was to accuse my opponent of cheating. But this rarely reversed the outcome. When my accusations did not work, I would let large tears stream down my cheeks and let my tears grow into a temper tantrum. Our president has lost the election. I am sorry he is angry and in pain. I never lost a presidential election, but I imagine it hurts big time. We are now witnessing the president's anger and denial. Now that he has dragged us through anger and denial, I imagine he is going also to drag us through all the other painful stages of grief and loss until he finally gets to acceptance. This might take years. It's time to move on. There is a pandemic that has killed over 250,000 Americans. Many Americans are without jobs and are unable to pay their rents coming due at the end of the month. We have schools struggling to teach our children without needed resources. And we have many people of color terrified of chance encounters with police officers. President Donald Trump has lost the election, and it is time to move on. We have important work to do. That's the letter submitted by George Burgess of Iowa City. The political cartoon is a timely representation of the Horn of Plenty, out of which are flowing globes of the spherical COVID-19 spiky molecules, the Horn of Plenty offering us lots of coronavirus this time of the year. And we have the 24-hour Dorman, Todd Dorman column, our LiveWithIt.gov seeks buy-in. Live With It is out. This Is Serious is in. If Iowans don't buy into this, we lose, Governor Kim Reynolds said in a primetime address to Iowans Tuesday on the worsening COVID-19 pandemic. Businesses will close once again. More schools will be forced to go online. Our healthcare system will fail and the cost of human life will be high. So now is the time to come together for the greater good. No one could remember a similar gubernatorial address, and it could have been truly historic had it happened weeks ago, when coronavirus infections, hospitalizations, and deaths were beginning their sharp ascent in Iowa. That's back when Reynolds was giving campaign speeches and tossing out hats to the maskless folks at a Trump rally. But in Tuesday, it was simply more damage control. Reynolds now is pleading for Iowans to take the virus seriously. She announced a mask mandate of sorts, requiring masks if you're inside and closer than 6 feet to other people for 15 minutes or more, unless it's a church or a school, or you're eating and drinking. Bring a mask, a flowchart, and a stopwatch, and also limit the size of gatherings, and ordered bars and restaurants to close at 10. With all the loopholes, the governor won't get the buy-in she's seeking. And looking at the awful numbers, we're already losing. Reynolds insists this is happening everywhere. But these Midwestern outbreaks with their sharp, steep climbs in cases and hospitalizations are clearly the nation's worst. Reynolds has been demanding we buy into a very different message for months. She told us over and over just to live with it. We threw open in much of the state in April and then did little beyond closing some college bars in September. Infectious disease experts have long predicted the dire consequences of our inaction, but the governor wouldn't buy in. Her team gave us numbers that don't add up. They kept key data secret and stonewalled journalists. Now more than 2,000 Iowans are dead, and the health care system has been pushed to the brink of unbuckling under COVID-19's weight. Always reactive, never proactive, Reynolds now needs our help. Many of us wear masks in public, practice distancing, and avoid large gatherings. The governor really needs to tell this to the stubbornly maskless on her side of the political divide. If she can't reach the Republican voters who just validated her approach, who can? Already, according to Bleeding Heartland State Representative Stephen Holt, Republican of Denison, took to Facebook to denounce the governor's order as unconstitutional and call for reevaluating her emergency powers. A small group of pastors also announced opposition, arguing mask rules, quote, violate the holy law of God, unquote. Or the governor could try dumping her feudal political balancing act and start listening to medical professionals in the trenches. Do what needs to be done to contain the virus explosion and pull hospitals back from the brink. Take strong, decisive action to save lives. A vaccine is coming, but there are hard, cold months ahead. Lead us, for God's sake, Governor. You want freedom? Control the virus. Worried about the economy? There's no recovery while the virus rages. You want buy-in, Governor? Stop selling us inaction, misinformation, and incompetence. That was the 24-hour Dorman column by Gazette columnist Todd Dorman. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on this Thursday, November 19th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. And among our other notices from Cedar Rapids, Elaine Therese Hansel, 84, died Wednesday, November 18, Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Marion. Guttenberg, Janet Mosier, 89, died Tuesday, November 17, the Took Allen Funeral Home, Guttenberg. From Kelowna, Nelson Beachy, 69, died Wednesday, November 18, Yoder Powell Funeral Home, Kelowna. From Marion, Donald L. Carstens, 82, died Tuesday, November 17, Chapman Funeral Home, Clarence. Also from Marion, Richard M. Sundermeyer, 78, died Wednesday, November 18, Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Marion. Newhall, Dorothy M. Ellis, 96, died Wednesday, November 18, Phillips Funeral Home, Vinton. St. Lucas, Helen Franzen, 77, died Monday, November 16, the Schluter Baylig Funeral Home, Decorah. And from Sigourney, Dorothy Buneman, 86, died Tuesday, November 17, Home Funeral Home, Sigourney. Now among our regular notices from Iowa City, Kevin G. Cumby, 76, passed away Sunday, November 15, at St. Luke's Hospital in Kansas City, Missouri, after a long illness. Memorial will be held at a later date in Newfoundland, place always close and dear to Kevin's heart. Memorial contributions may be made to Forest O. Triplett Animal Shelter of Chillicothe, may be left at or mailed to Lindley Funeral Home, Post Office Box 47, Chillicothe, Missouri, 64601. Online condolences at the website lindleyfuneralhomes.com. That was the obituary for Kevin G. Cumby of Iowa City. From Anamosa, Francis, known as Fran Betty Foxen, 77, passed away Sunday, November 15. The memorial service will be held graveside 1 p.m. December 5th, Holy Cross Cemetery in Anamosa. The service will be officiated by Father Nick March. You may leave online condolences for the family of Francis Fran Betty Foxen at iowacremation.com. From Coggin, Mary Roberta Monahan Coleman, 94, passed away Sunday, November 15, from natural causes at Mercy Medical Center, Cedar Rapids, after a sudden illness. A private family visitation and mass of Christian burial, St. Patrick Catholic Church, Monty, Iowa, the Reverend Wayne Dressler officiating. Interment, St. Patrick's Catholic Cemetery, Monty. Fawcett Schmidt's Funeral Home, Winthrop, is assisting the family. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed on behalf of the family of Mary Roberta Monahan Coleman to the Coggin Historical Society, Monty Community Center, the Coggin Opera House, or to charities of choice. Online condolences, Jameson Schmidt's Funeral Home.com. From Marion, Virginia DeChant, 88, died Friday, November 13, celebration of life, 1 p.m. Friday, November 20, at Olive Bev Memorial Chapel, Phillipsburg, Kansas, zip is 67661, Phillipsburg, Kansas, Bev, B-O-E-V-E, Memorial Chapel. Facebook page, it will be streamed on that chapel's Facebook page. The burial will follow in the Fairview Cemetery, Phillipsburg. Family will receive friends 7 to 8:30 p.m. Thursday at the funeral chapel. That was for Virginia DeChant of Marion. From Cedar Rapids, Patrick J. McMickle, Jr. He died on November 14th. Because of COVID, condolences may be sent to 2708 Q Avenue Northwest, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, 52405, or Patrick J. McMickle, Jr. From Cedar Rapids, Patrick Joseph Morrissey, 61, passed away Saturday, November 14, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City due to injuries suffered in an accident. He will be in Pat Joseph Morrissey will be interred at Mount Calvary Cemetery. There will be a private service for family and friends at a later date. To honor Pat, please make a donation to your local animal shelter in his name. From Cedar Rapids, Brent J. Paul, P-A-H-L, Brent L. Paul, 67, died Tuesday, November 17, at his home after a long, courageous battle with brain cancer. Private family memorial services at Cedar Memorial Park of Memories. The service will be live-streamed at 11 a.m. Monday, November 23, and may be viewed at client.tribucast.com. Interment at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. The Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements for Brent L. Paul. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be given to Hope Lutheran Church or to the Howard Cherry Scout Preservation. The Paul family will receive tributes and condolences at the website cedarmemorial.com. From Tipton, James K. Mente, M-E-N-T-E. James K. Mente, 88, of Tipton, formerly of Tipton, passed away Monday, November 16, at the Vinton Lutheran Home. There will be a private family service held at Chapman Funeral Home in Clarence, with the Reverend Matt Schneider Adams officiating. Burial will follow at St. John's Cemetery in Clarence with military honors. Cards may be sent to Denise at 5067 27th Avenue, Walker, 52352. Also, memorials and condolences may be offered at the funeral site at the website ChapmanFuneralHome.com. ChapmanFH.com. That was for James K. Ment, M-E-N-T-E. From Cedar Rapids, John E., known as Jack Smith, 95, passed away Wednesday, November 18, at Keystone Cedars in Cedar Rapids. His body has been donated to University of Iowa Deeded Body Program. Per Jack's request, no services will be held. The University of Iowa's Spring Memorial Service will honor Jack. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion, Iowa, is assisting the family of John E. Jack Smith, at which you can leave a memorial, murdochfuneralhome.com. Cedar Rapids, Beverly Ann Wilson, 79, passed away Thursday, November 12th, at Mercy Medical Center, Cedar Rapids. Her body has been cremated. Services will be held at a later date. Memorial contributions may be directed to the family and may be mailed to Post Office Box 62, Eldon, Iowa, 52554. Friends may leave online condolences at CranstonFamilyFuneralHome.com for Beverly Ann Wilson of Cedar Rapids. From Hiawatha, Virginia Therese Magnifico, 97, of Hiawatha, died Friday, November 13, at the Hiawatha Care Center of Natural Causes, following a long and happy life. Family gravesite service will be held at a later date near her home of Arlington Heights, Illinois. Tehan Funeral and Cremation is assisting the family of Virginia Therese Magnifico, at which you can leave condolences at its website. From Manchester, Garneth Nadine Hook, 87, passed away Wednesday, November 18, at Marietta's Place in Manchester. Online condolences may be sent to Leonard Muller funeralhome.com for Garneth Nadine Hook, private family service Saturday, November 21, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home, Manchester. The Reverend Kurt Pasco officiating. There will be interment will be at the Grand View Cemetery. Visitation for the family of Garneth Nadine Hook will be on Friday, November 20, 3 to 7 p.m. at the Leonard Muller Funeral Home, Manchester. And from Newhall, we have Donald C. Kirker, 90, passed away Monday, November 16, at home in the loving arms of his family due to complications of the coronavirus. Private family service will be held at St. Paul's Catholic Church in Newhall for Donald C. Kirker. Graveside service, 1:15 p.m. Saturday, November 21, at the Davenport Memorial Park. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Condolences may be left at the website phillipsfuneralhomes.com for Donald C. Kirker. And finally, from Van Horn, Bernadine Nelson Barr, 93, passed away Tuesday, November 17, St. Luke's Hospital after a brief illness. Interment and ceremony will take place for family and friends 11 a.m. Friday, November 20, at Evergreen Cemetery in Vinton. The ceremony will be officiated by Pastor Leonard Ranson of Salem United Methodist Church, Van Horn. Condolences may be sent to 106 10th Street, Van Horn, 52346. The PhillipsFuneralHomes.com is the place to offer condolences for Bernadine Nelson Barr of Van Horn. And those are the obituaries listed in today's Gazette. We turn now to the sports section, and the prep sports news highlights the high school football finals being played in Cedar Falls this week. And this one is by K.J. Pilcher, Regina's WIC, Rolling Up Wow Plays. Iowa City Regina coach Marv Cook witnessed almost everything one could on a football field. His All-State, All-American, and All-NFL career occurred alongside some of the sport's greats at every level. He analyzed college players for TV broadcasts. Cook transformed the Regals into a perennial power, winning six straight titles from 2010 to 2016 and reaching the finals four more times over 14 seasons. You don't do all that without recognizing and seeing lots of skill, which makes it even more impressive when he says wide receiver Alec Wick still provides him with wow moments. From week one, it's been that like, have you seen that? Have you seen that before? Then week two, it seems like every week you're saying, did you see that? Did that really just happen? He's made some phenomenal play. Even more impressive is that Wick has returned from a nasty hip injury in last year's quarterfinal that required surgery and sidelined him for the semifinal to leading 11-player football in receiving yards and touchdowns. His efforts have helped second-ranked Regina reach a showdown with number one Grundy Center in the Class A state championship today at the Unidome in Cedar Falls starting at 2 p.m. Regina, now 10-1, is looking for its eighth title. The Spartans, 11-0, are the last obstacle in front of the first since 2015. The goal has been winning it all with the guys beside you, playing with your teammates one last chance, Wick said. This team will never be recreated. We can't take that for granted and play each week to the best of our ability. Something he didn't get to do in last season's finale. Wick was injured and carted off the field on a stretcher after making a catch late in a 20-30 win over West Branch that let Regina reach the Unidome. Wick had surgery the following Monday. He still joined teammates while on crutches for a semifinal loss to Van Meter. It sucked not being able to play with them, but I also had to be there and help them, Wick said. I had to still support them, let them know what they were doing right and wrong if I could help. Last week's experience was much more enjoyable. He finished with 128 receiving yards on 9 catches in a 49-28 victory over number 3 St. Ansgar, bringing his season total to 1,175 yards on 66 catches. Wick didn't reach the end zone Friday, but he is tied for third in the state with 15 TDs. It was a great atmosphere, Wick said. It was fun to be in there and play with the team again. The 6'1", 180-pounder produced one of those big, eye-popping, shake-your-head moments, making a juggling, acrobatic 36-yard catch on 2nd and 21 in the third that led to a score. The catch he made Friday, Cook said, the defender literally had his arms in the middle of his catch radius and punched it out at one point. He caught it like three different times through the process, going to the ground. It's just amazing. He kind of makes that routine. He has a special knack. The versatile senior is far from one-dimensional. The jack-of-all-trades converted all seven extra point attempts, giving him 40 this season. The team leader in interceptions added one against the Saints. He added four solo tackles, ranking fourth on the team in stops with 35. He even averaged 39.5 yards per punt in the semifinal. Cook said Wick has served as a quiet leader by example his entire career. He has demonstrated toughness from the start and grown as a person as well as a player. As good as we thought he was last year, he's been more dynamic and special as a player this season, Cook said. His first start as a freshman, offensively and defensively, was against Cedar Rapids Xavier. He played as a freshman. He took some big hits, but he kept getting up and answering the bell. It's been an incredible career watching this kid play. He can flat out play. The article is accompanied by several pictures of Regina's Alec Wick in action during games this season. Another football story from Marion by Jeff Linder reporting. James steps down at Linmar. Despite the win-loss record, Paul James called his 4 years as head football coach at Linmar fulfilling and a great experience. I had a lot of gratifying things happen here, James said Thursday in confirming his resignation. The wins and losses didn't always work out, but that's not everything. James, 66, steps down after posting a 12-22 record, including a district title and playoff appearance in 2019. He said the COVID-19 pandemic has affected some things I'm able to do coaching-wise, and I need to look out for the health of my wife, Karen, and me. Linmar Athletics Director David Brown said, Paul's impact on the youth of the metro area over the past several decades is unparalleled. He has given his time to make a difference in the lives of countless young student-athletes in the area as they develop into leaders in our community. When you get to know Paul, you understand that his successes in the athletic venues he has coached in have never been measured by wins and losses, but rather by the relationships he has developed along the way. James took the Linmar job in 2016 after coaching at Cedar Rapids, Washington for 34 years, beginning as an assistant in 1976. He spent two stints as the head coach at Washington in 1995 through 2006 and 2013 through 2016, compiling a record of 97-57. The Warriors were Class 4A state runners-up in 2003 and 2014. His career record is 109-79. He was asked if he would consider coaching again post-COVID. Probably not, he said. I think that's it for me this time. The article is accompanied by a picture of Linmar coach Paul James watching his players warm up before a game against Iowa City West in 2018. At the Linmar High School in Marion. With the conclusion of the high school volleyball season and tournaments, the Gazette lists the area first team honorees. In Class 5A, Cassidy Hartman, a sophomore from Iowa City Liberty. Class 4A, Jasmine Yamalkowski, a senior from Cedar Rapids Xavier. Eve McGill, a senior from Cedar Rapids Xavier, Ella Kolok, a junior from West Delaware, Elise Winter, a senior from Cedar Rapids Xavier, Meg Bessler, a senior from Western Dubuque. In Class 3A, Lauren Schrock, a senior from Mount Vernon, Belle Weber, a senior from Union Community, and in Class 2A, Kirsten Schmidt, a junior from Dyersville Beckman, and those were the honorees, first team on the All-State Volleyball. On the living page, we have Allison Gowans reporting, Popoli closing. Popoli Restaurant and Sullivan's Bar in Kingston Village will close on December 20, according to November 12 Facebook post by the owners. We wish to thank all of our loyal customers, employees, suppliers, and service providers for their support for the past 6-plus years. This was a difficult decision during a difficult time for many restaurants, the post said. In reflection, Popoli owners are proud of the undertaking of the restoration of this historic building after it was damaged and closed after the flood of 2008. The restaurant portion of the building is listed on the National Register of Historic Places and designed by the famous architect Louis Sullivan for People's Bank in 2010. The iconic vault room and doors, the murals, the stained glass, the chandeliers, the teller bars, the marble, and the many other unique architectural features were restored and maintained for many to enjoy while dining at Popoli. Popoli is also proud of the support they have provided for the community and Kingston Village throughout the years. The restaurant at 101 3rd Avenue Southwest opened in 2014. It was named to Preservation Iowa's Most Endangered Properties list in 2012. Fred Timko and Gary Rozek bought the building from Wells Fargo, which worked with Timko and Rozek to restore the place. The owners will pause and decide on next steps for the restaurant part of the building. They are hopeful a use can be found that honors the historic significance and beauty of the building and interior. The remainder of the building will continue to operate as an important commercial space for I'm On Communications and KeyPro's physical therapy and performance, the Facebook post said. Equipment and information related to the catering business will be transferred to Popoli managing partner Jude Valenfana, who will operate as Peppercorn Food Company. And finally, from the Business 380 page, Cidery Delivery Platform Merge. John Stepp reports from Iowa City, Rapid Creek Cidery and Iowa Delivery have merged, the companies announced Wednesday. Katie Goring, the co-owner of Rapid Creek Cidery and Wilson's Orchard and Farm, also co-owns Iowa Delivery with her brother Jacob Goring. The merger allows Rapid Creek Cidery and Wilson's to deliver to Iowa City and some of the surrounding communities. Being able to develop a proprietary delivery system which has been proven at scale is a big advantage, Katie Goring said in a news release. It will allow us to achieve necessary efficiencies and also provide a superior customer experience. Meanwhile, the merger gives Iowa Delivery its first hub for customer pickups. The company is seeking to partner with more companies to develop hubs, according to the website. Iowa Delivery requires a $30 minimum order and charges a $6 delivery fee. In the future, we plan to leverage software, hardware, and apply technologies to further enhance our local farm and food system, Jacob Gary said in the release. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for this Thursday, November 19th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle. So it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.